today at Reader's Corner, C.J. Box, author of the new novel, Three Inch Teeth, a Joe Pickett novel. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, best-selling novelist C.J. Box talks with us about his thrilling new novel, Three Inch Teeth, a Joe Pickett novel. His 24th featuring Wyoming game warden Joe Pickett has Joe facing two different species of rampaging beasts. One animal, a rogue grizzly bear with a thirst for blood, and one human, an ex-con seeking revenge for those who locked him up, including Joe. In addition to his 24 Joe Pickett novels, CJ is also the author of a number of standalone novels and a story collection. Among his many awards, he's won the Edgar, the Anthony, the McCavity, the Gumshoe, and two Barry Awards for his work. An avid outdoorsman, Joe is also, excuse me, that would be CJ, is also an executive producer of Joe Pickett on Paramount Plus, as well as Big Sky, both of which are based on his novels. CJ Box, welcome to Reader's Corner. Welcome to Idaho.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm quite familiar with Idaho. Prior to the books taking off, I used to have a company that promoted Idaho, as well as other Rocky Mountain states in Europe. So I spent a lot of time touring it, Idaho, taking tour operators and journalists around from all over the world and enjoying the state.
Well, I am in particular familiar with your work, because I moved to the West, to Boise, Idaho, in 2003. And I thought, how am I going to really get to know what it's like living in the West, the beauty of the West, the challenges of the West? I think I'll pick up this novel that C.J. Box wrote. And so there in my first few years in Boise, I had the advantage, I would say, of reading some of your work. Let's get right into it. My gosh, now 24 Joe Pickett novels later, what was your original inspiration for the Joe Pickett protagonist?
Well, originally, Joe Pickett was introduced in a book called Open Season that came out in 2001, believe it or not. At the time, I was more focused on the issue within that book, which was about the Endangered Species Act and how well-meaning legislation sometimes goes awry on the ground where it's supposed to take place. So for me, it was about that and about a kind of I was a journalist at the time, and I was following very interesting story where a species thought extinct called black-footed ferrets were discovered in outside of a small town in Wyoming. And what fascinated me at the time was that everybody had been looking for these critters for years and years and years. And it turns out everybody in the town knew they were there, but nobody let anybody know because they knew what kind of impact that would make. So I wanted to rewrite that as kind of a New West novel. And the best protagonist, at least to carry the story, was a game warden who would be involved in that particular situation. I wasn't planning a series. It was a book. But when it was finally bought by Putnam Sons in New York, they wanted two more novels with Joe Pickett, and that's how the series was born.
Oh, that's a great beginning. And by the way, that is the first book I read. I picked it up when I got here, and I remember now that you describe it, the plot. So
great.
I mentioned in the intro that you've been, you know, on Netflix with this Joe Pickett series and then the Big Sky series. Amazing to have two of those going at various times. What's it like for an author to do that? What's your role in the script, or maybe it's just handing it over to a screenwriter? I know that happens regularly. I'm sure you were a consultant in some way, but did that take a lot of your time?
It did not take a lot of my time. I'm an executive producer, as they call it, on both shows.
Uh-huh.
But basically, my role, as I see it, was to provide the source material, the books, and be available for consultation and talk about narrative arcs of an entire season. But I was not involved in the day-to-day casting, script writing, that kind of thing. Both series were shot. One series was shot in Canada, the other one in New Mexico and Canada for a while. So it wasn't easy for me to get to the sets.
Really?
And when I did, I didn't spend a lot of time there. There's not a lot to do on a set other than sit in a tent and watch the same scene being shot over and over and over. I didn't, you know, some authors really want to get involved in the day-to-day. Largely, they're not successful with it because it's a whole different medium. And I realized that early on is that the best thing I could do was provide the source material and hope they did the best with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've talked to some authors who actually had to get a cameo out of it. So, you know, somewhere in that film, there's a very brief shot of somebody who just happens to be the guy responsible for the whole shebang.
Well, there's a 3-second cameo of me, one of the Joe Pickett episodes. But boy, if you blink, you miss it. So I haven't emphasized that too much.
Yeah. Well, CJ, let's talk about 3-inch teeth. Why don't you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what this novel's about? I mentioned it in the intro, but if you want to fill in anything else, this would be the time to do it. And then I've got some specific questions that come to mind after reading the novel.
Sure. With all of the books, I wanted, you know, I concentrate on an issue or controversy, something happening in the Mountain West in the contemporary time, and then build the plot around that. And I became very interested and fascinated with the growing number of grisly human encounters that have been happening in the West over the last 5 years or so. So 3-inch teeth is a reference to grizzly bears. Their fangs are sometimes 3 inches long, 350-pound animal, sometimes up to 400 pounds. And there were 2 years ago, at least 3 fatalities in Wyoming with grizzly bears. You're from Idaho, you know there's been grizzly bears encounters there,
right?
In some cases growing every year. I became fascinated with that. Anybody who spends much time outdoors in the Mountain West suddenly has to think about grizzly bears, where maybe they hadn't for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied the cases. I was able to get a lot of help on grizzly bear behavior from a man who works for the Game and Fish Department in Wyoming, who's the large predator specialist for the state, and also the lead member of what's called the Predator Attack Team. And it's kind of like a SWAT team that's sent out whenever there's a mauling or a fatality. They're the first people on the ground. And I learned a lot about grizzly bears, their behavior, their proclivities. And the scariest fact to me was that in some cases, not all, but in some cases, the attacks were done without any kind of provocation from the victims. You know, you grow up in the West always hearing that if you do certain things, you have bear spray with you, you make noise, you know, you never get between a sow and her cubs, that you're basically going to be okay. But in some rare instances, grizzly bears hunt and attack people without provocation.
So you mentioned the large carnivore section supervisor for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. That would be Dan Thompson, who you acknowledge in your acknowledgments at the end of the book. And if right. I can quote it, you thank him for his, quote, invaluable in-person experience and research in and around Wyoming. And I just have to ask, does that mean you ever went out with him and do what he does or stand alongside him as he does what he does?
Oh, no, I was not a ride along on any of the Predator Attack Team missions.
Yeah.
But I've spoken to 2 of the members of the Predator Attack Team.
Uh-huh.
to get their insights on certain fatalities, certain cases. You know, in one case that really chilled me, there was a sow and a cub who killed a elk hunting guide outside of Jackson. And when the helicopter with the Predator Attack Team arrived, the bears attacked the helicopter.
Wow.
Things that bears are not supposed to do. And so it made me realize how unpredictable bears can be although it's this book is not an indictment of grizzly bears, but it is right. an exploration of some grizzly bears who go rogue.
Yeah. You're listening to CJ Box. He's the author of 3-Inch Teeth, the 24th novel featuring Joe Pickett, the Wyoming game warden. Well, let's talk about the details, because you inform the reader. How many grizzlies are in Wyoming in the surrounding area?
A lot more yeah. than I realized. I'm trying to remember the exact number. It seems like around 1,100 or 1,200, possibly more. You know, the wildlife officials who monitor grizzlies do, you know, manage to capture and tag and collar some of them, but not all of them. And I think if anybody follows grizzly bear encounters around the West, they'll notice that where it used to be grizzly number 163, we're now into the 500s of grizzly bears who've been captured and collared, and there's a lot more that have not been captured and collared.
So the grizzly is protected by the Endangered Species Act, which you mentioned earlier, because, of course, that was the subject of your novel, your first Joe Pickett novel, Open Season. Now, if they're protected, they're going to be protected until they go after humans, I suppose. How do you feel the Endangered Species Act works when it comes to grizzlies today? Is that still required?
It is, but it varies from state to state. I should answer that. It varies from time to time. It varies on the circumstances. Sometimes bears are simply relocated if they were provoked in some way. Other times bears have to be eliminated because they're so dangerous. So, and that's usually done by the state, at least in Wyoming, the state Game and Fish Department, as opposed to the federal agencies that oversee the Endangered Species Act.
So one way of looking at the plot of your book is that every action has a reaction, and there is a grizzly killing described in your book that has everything to do with the plot. It's about Grizzly 413 and her cubs. And this seems to be where you may have a very subtle message that as more and more people move into the rural West, we're going to have these animal encounters, whether it's grizzlies or mountain lions or whatever. Could you give our listeners the background without spoiling any of the twists and the turns, I guess, as to what happens here with Grizzly 413 and why is that important for the book?
Sure. In real life, certain grizzly bears, they usually, you know, numbers are assigned to them, have become almost celebrities. They're well known to people, to visitors, to like Yellowstone National Park, to animal activists who follow grizzly bears and appreciate grizzly bears. They come out of their dens every year. They may have more cubs this year than last year. So they get to be well known. And in this case, this bear in the fictional bear in the book is based on a real bear who had a human encounter in Yellowstone Park. I won't give too much detail on that because it's a spoiler. In the park, who then kind of lost her mind. And so this the fictionalized story kind of replicates a real one of a bear that got to be well known and encountered humans in a bad situation, and then their behavior went screwy.
The reason I asked that question about the incidences of those moments when humans and animals interact is that we've interviewed Bryce Andrews here on the show, who's up in Montana, where he wrote a couple of books. But the second one, Down from the Mountain, as you may know, is the story of a grizzly that comes into contact with humans. And Bryce, as it turns out, has kind of made it a career objective of his to create ways to keep grizzlies and humans apart from each other. And again, I couldn't help but notice that at one point in your book where some grizzly cubs are run over, and I'll just put it this way, the culprit was an out-of-stater distracted by his phone. and you will know that I didn't specifically name the state, but I'll bet almost anybody who's listening to this from the West knows what state I'm talking about, but that's irrelevant. Any thoughts on that?
No, other than, you know, not only, you know, are more encounters happening because of the population increase into their habitat in the West, but also because some grizzly bears tend to kind of lose their fear of humans. And, you know, as the large predator specialist told me, bears are hardwired not to interact with humans. But once that line is crossed, they're much more likely to do it again and to move out and to spend, you know, some grizzly bears range much, much further than most people realize. And that's part of what the 3-inch teeth is about, is that what appears to be grizzly bear attacks and killings are happening hundreds of miles apart in different parts of Wyoming over a very short period of time, which absolutely vexes everybody who's after the problem bear because it doesn't make sense.
Right. Tell us about the mama bears and their role in the novel. And I assume that they've been ripped from some form of reality in some form or fashion.
They have.
Yeah.
In the book, it's a couple of women who are activists. They love grizzly bears. They spend time in Yellowstone Park. They name grizzly bears. They know their habits. And they kind of adopt these bears as their own. And they are activists in the book. They try to thwart the predator attack team at every turn to save the bear. Those are the group doesn't really exist, the mama bears, but they're based on a few activist groups who do exist and are as much a problem sometimes for the game and fish authorities as the bears themselves. In that, you know, these people are, they're well-meaning, they love the bears, but when they thwart efforts to take out a problem bear, then that makes it more likely that bear will kill again. So having talked to officials, part of their job now is also encountering people who are out there trying to save the bears.
And I don't want to give anything away, but to your credit, by the time one reads the very last line of this novel, as it turns out, these women, the mama bears, knew what they were talking about.
To some degree, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about another aspect. Again, I get such a kick out of learning so many different things about the West. I'm sure this doesn't happen just in the West, but Joe Pickett's daughter runs a bird abatement business. Tell us about that. And again, I assume there are such needs out there for people like Joe's daughter.
Sure. Falconry has played a very important part in all of the Joe Pickett books ever since the introduction of Nate Romanowski, who is Joe's friend. He's an outlaw falconer with a special forces background. He carries one of the largest and most powerful handguns in the world, and he's got his own code. And he, in the past, was a falconer outlaw off the grid, but over the last few years in the books, has married and has a child and has started a legitimate business, which is the bird abatement business. These things really exist. You can look them up. And that is that falconers are hired by places like golf courses, refineries, zoos, to chase off problem birds like starlings or pigeons or other kind of birds that bother the operations. Because when a falcon is in the air, a lot of the target birds are hardwired to know that that's a problem for them, and they'll just leave the area. So it's kind of a non-lethal way of ridding problem birds from areas. And that's what Nate Romanowski does now. And his employee is Sheridan Pickett, Joe Pickett's oldest daughter. And she gets her first on her own assignment in 3-inch teeth to go to a remote ranch near Walden, Colorado, and rid a rancher of an infestation of starlings.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is best-selling novelist C.J. Box, talking with us about his new book, 3-Inch Teeth, a Joe Pickett novel. You know, I always have so much difficulty asking questions of a novelist while at the same time protecting the information and the plot of the book. But there was a somewhat of a twist. Maybe it's not a twist, but a development in Joe's daughter's experience in Colorado, which was very personal to Joe. And I don't know whether you want to actually describe that, but I thought it was interesting that you chose in this novel to actually take us back to Joe's earlier life. Could you comment on that in any way?
Sure. It's just one of those things I was thinking about is that, you know, 24 books, 24 years into the series, readers really don't know that much about Joe's childhood. There's a few paragraphs in the first couple of books that refer to kind of a troubled past, but I'd never really gotten into it. And I thought it was time to revisit that and that this was a way to do it.
Well, it was very well done. And I think your answer is so much appropriate because it really doesn't give anything away. By the way, I had to be amused by one thing that is probably one sentence in this 300 plus page novel, but I'm just curious about one really dumb move that you describe being made by a visiting hiker to Wyoming who buys bear spray, which I carry, but have never had to use. And I certainly didn't do with it what this guy did. He applies it like sunscreen.
Right.
So, I mean, does that come from some experience that you heard about?
It does. Really? It does. I a few years ago, I set books in and around Yellowstone Park. And one of the years I was researching that in Yellowstone, I spoke to some employees at the local medical clinic, and they said every year somebody is brought in there having sprayed themselves with bear spray.
Oh, my gosh.
Like as if it was mosquito repellent.
Right.
So it
right.
does happen. It happens almost every year.
Yeah, that's just amazing. And of course, we always have to warn people who are going to go out and buy bear spray now that they also need to get whatever it is that protects your eyes from what you spray, because sometimes that gets that pepper spray gets pretty tough.
Oh, it's vicious stuff. I've done it myself. I remember before going on a wilderness horseback trip into Yellowstone, testing a can of bear spray to make sure it worked.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, the wind's always blowing in Wyoming, and I shot it and the wind blew it back into me, and it was miserable. Both my daughter and I went running into our garage choking and crying. So it's very effective.
Yeah. Have you had any personal encounters with a grizzly in your hiking over the years?
I have. I was fishing in Yellowstone Park a few years ago, way in the backcountry, and there was a grizzly upstream from me who came down and actually went after some ducks in the water, got a couple of them, and then retreated, and I retreated as well. And I was staying in a little wilderness cabin, and that night the bear came to the cabin. And there were great big muddy paw prints on the front door the next morning. So that's, other than seeing them from a distance, that's the closest encounter I've had.
Yeah, well, that's close enough for me. Believe me, that's interesting. You know, I have a question about the landscape that you describe in your novel. I mean, I think what makes your novels so enticing for those who love the American West or want to experience the American West is just what a great job you do in laying it out for people. And right at toward the beginning of the book, there's a fly fisherman who is in the 12 Sleep River fishing, and you describe the landscape surrounding it. I'm curious, do you sit down at your computer and simply make up this landscape based on your years and years of Wyoming? Or do you actually go out into the field and see some of these places and think, now I've got to recreate this scene in my next novel?
Well, the answer to that is both. But this is actually the first chapter of the book. I'm an avid fly fisherman, and where one of the places that I fish in Wyoming is exactly that canyon and that river and that with those kind of views and the steep hillsides coming into yes. the river. So for me, it wasn't that hard to recreate. It's funny though, the ranch owner who owns that piece of the river, I gave him that chapter to read. And afterwards he said, thanks. Now I'll never be able to go fishing there again.
Well, let's hope we have plenty of readers who aren't fly fishermen or women, and we'll be okay in that in that respect. You mentioned the Wyoming Hunger Initiative in your novel. Was that a plug, or were you just carried away with the plot?
No, yeah, actually, my wife is on the board. Uh-huh. So yo, it's a plug.
Yeah.
But I always put a lot of little insider things in all of the books that people in the West and in Wyoming will recognize, but you know, probably other readers from other parts of the country, they'll skate right over it.
Yeah. There's a mention in your book of a former uranium mining town, which is called Jeffrey City. I assume that's probably also ripped from some form of reality.
Right. There really is an old uranium town called Jeffrey City, and I think it's described very accurately in the book. There's some talk that it might be revived now that prices of uranium are up and people are looking at it again. But at one time it was a little mini boom town, and now it's an absolute ghost town.
So is there going to be a 25th Joe Pickett novel?
There certainly is. I'm halfway done with it now. These things are done, you know, a year ahead. So, yeah, other than this book coming out, which is going to give me a break in it, I'm going to return to it as soon as I'm back and, you know, get it out there this summer to the publisher.
I know that authors don't like to share too much about their upcoming works because you want to be able to surprise the reader, and you don't want anybody walking off with that idea. But is there a particular theme you could at least mention that this book is going to be about?
Well, the next book is very much going to be a Nate Romanowski book based on the events that happened in the end of Three Inch Teeth. You know, the reader knows that Nate Romanowski is going after the bad guys, and that's what happens in the next book.
Oh, I can't wait for that one then. We'll be there, believe me. When you are asked by people about your series, are you ever able to name a place to start? I mean, obviously, you start at the beginning with Open Season, I guess. But for somebody who's just coming into the world of C.J. Box, what do you tell a reader where to go? Is there a favorite of yours, for example?
Not necessarily a favorite. There are several in this. I think most of the books are standalone. I think this book stands alone. Uh-huh. Anybody could pick it up and not know the backstory and be quickly caught up, I hope. Mm-hmm. And that's how I try to write them, so that longtime readers aren't, you know, pummeled with backstory they already know, and new readers are caught up pretty quickly. Yeah. You know, my wife always tells everybody, start with Open Season, because then, you know, readers can follow the Joe and his family as they grow up. Their books are told in real time. Everybody gets older as the series progresses. I would say whatever, you know, pick up any book. They're all kind of standalones. I do know that there are a lot of readers who pick up the newest one for the first time and then go back and start at the beginning. So there's no right or wrong way.
Yeah. And then there's always the series that people can tune into if they want to get up on things. Well, CJ, I'd like to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner, and a special thanks for writing Three Inch Teeth, the 24th Joe Pickett novel. This is just a great way to be drawn into great suspense. Thanks for joining us at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me, and hi to all my friends in Idaho.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.